Turning our attention next to climate and weather, and certainly when we think about weather here today for a good share of Wisconsin, I think things got, after kind of a nice day across a good part of the state, things got cold, especially in southern Wisconsin. We'll talk about that and answer your weather questions or your climate questions as we visit with John Martin. With me in the studio, John, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John,
thanks. Good to be here, Larry.
And and who knows where Steve Ackerman is?
I'm off here in Washington, D.C., the state's capital.
Oh, wonderful.
Not state capital, the country's capital.
Yeah. The country's capital. Well, it's good to have you with us by phone as well. And you missed some really cold, a cold morning this morning.
Yeah, boy.
Steve.
Yeah, I had heard that. Someone sent me an animation of one of these things called pneumonia fronts where the temperature was in the 70s and then all of a sudden it was in the 40s.
It was probably over 80 yesterday afternoon in a lot of locations. It was beautiful, Steve. It was like a summer day. Dew point near 60, and then boom, the roof fell in.
Now, why did it fall in, John?
Oh, we're still just too close to northern Canada at this time of year. I mean, you can still get some really cold air masses that build up there, and if you get us in a general northwesterly flow well above the ground, it's only a matter of time before that cold air funnels in. And in early or even as early as or even as late as early June, you can still get those really rapid temperature drops. They become less frequent, but this is about the end of the road for such a thing.
Oh.
But we got a good one.
So, Steve, what's the weather like in Washington, D.C.?
It's going to get up into the 80s today. It was close to the 80s yesterday, and it's staying up there in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, the heck with you.
Yeah, no kidding.
I think our lows are in the 60s. But it is starting to get that, you know, typical humidity of the East Coast, which I generally don't like.
Yeah.
It's too hot and muggy for me.
Yeah, it's a tough place to be from about June 1st to September 1st.
That's why we're leaving next week.
Well, I tell you what, the tornadoes this year, I was reading or watching on television, I think it was a little report on tornadoes, and this is one of the worst starts to the tornado season we've ever had.
Yeah, we're usually at about 500 or 600 storms, reported storms by this time of year. I think we're at about 1,000 right now. So there's been a substantially larger number of tornadoes and more fatalities by far this year than we've ever had. I think, than we usually have by this time of year, I should have said. Usually we're on a pace for about 54 tornado fatalities per year, and we're already at 100.
Yeah.
And the season's got a month to go. In the real Tornado Alley regions, it's got a whole month to go.
And the real Tornado Alley region is
Oklahoma, Kansas, western Missouri, places like that, right?
Yeah. And
Wisconsin already got hit, right?
Yeah, we had a tornado in January.
Oh, that's right.
And then we had, I don't know if we've had any in that latest round of severe weather on the weekend or not, but we had, in places in Iowa, had softball-size hail. Just an incredible array of severe weather elements on the weekend.
Can we blame this on anything, La Nina or something like that?
There's some statistical evidence that seems to suggest that when the tropical Pacific Ocean's a little cooler than normal, as it is now and it has been all through the winter, that tends to be associated with a larger number of thunderstorm days in the Central Plains. Now, whether or not that really has much to do with tornadoes, per se, is a little bit less obvious, although there has been some research to look at just the tornado frequency with respect to a cool tropical Pacific, and there is some evidence that suggests they're connected. How they're connected physically, we don't particularly well know, but there might be some statistical correlation.
Hmm. You can join in, by the way, with your weather questions or climate questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, send us an email, and we'll be happy to get you on the air. Does La Nina have much of an impact on Wisconsin weather, by the way, or is it?
Generally not. You know, we get really impacted more on the flip side of La Nina, or the El Nino, which impacts the winters. But La Nina, which is what we've been in, and that's kind of weakening right now, is really not significantly correlated with any of the types of weather that we've been able to see in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag.
So the 100 inches of snow that we had in southern Wisconsin this last winter wouldn't have been caused by or had any effect from La Nina? Or
I don't think so. And the reason I'll say that is because we've had other cold episodes in the Pacific in the last 25 years and haven't approached 100 inches of snow. So there's certainly something else going on that got us over that century mark.
I'm quite certain it was the fact that I went on sabbatical.
I'm sure it was, too. You and Morgan.
There's a really strong statistical correlation between record snowfalls and me leaving for the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an amazing winter.
And had occasion to see two different couples who are just now back from Florida with Cheshire cat grins on their faces. They asked me about how the winter went.
But your shoulders and back are stronger.
Michael in Hillsboro's online. Michael, hi. Thank you for calling.
You're very welcome. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding global warming. You'd have to be about brain dead not to be aware of all the talk that's going on about that. And what continues to occur to me in my mind is the fact that you have two views of the world, either the biblical view where perhaps the Earth is 10,000 years old, or the evolutionary Darwinistic view, where the Earth is perhaps 4.5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. And whichever view you ascribe to, I think we're still stuck with reliable weather data that goes back perhaps to the 1500s or 1600s at the most for parts of the world. And shucks, the North American continent wasn't even fully settled into the 1800s. So from a statistical view, the reliable weather data that we can accumulate seems insignificant. Or you want to make a case for global warming, whether you ascribe to the biblical view and a 10,000-year-old Earth or the Darwinistic view and the 4.5 billion-year-old Earth. Well, I would just like to hear a comment on that, please.
All right. Thanks for calling, Michael. Steve, do you want to start?
I would look at it from two points of view. One is with regard to our instrument records, which generally go back a couple of hundred years. But even when we look at that instrument record, when we're looking at the changes in the last 20 years or so, we can see a really significant change in the temperature of the Earth. And that physical change that we see with the instruments is very well correlated with other changes we're seeing naturally, like changes in ice sheets, changes in glaciers, and things like that. So I think that evidence clearly points to the fact that the globe is warming. When we go to more longer time frames, before we had instruments on North America or South America or even invented, it becomes more of a detective work where, again, we're looking at indications from nature itself. So, for example, we may look at pollen sediments in lakes on the continent. As we know, there are tree types prefer certain temperature conditions. And so as we drill into lake beds and look at the sediments of different pollens, as we see pollens change from like maple trees to pine trees and to aspen trees, that's an indication for us of how the temperature is changing. And again, when we look at those records as well as records of air bubbles and ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland, the whole picture holds together that the types of changes, the rapidity of the changes in temperature we're seeing now are just things that we haven't experienced in the past.
Yeah, and one thing that was not mentioned so much there, Steve, was the chemical composition of the atmosphere has been detectably changed, exactly coincident with industrialization, and even to the degree that molecular oxygen, what you and I breathe as we're talking to each other, has gone down in exactly the correct increment to account for burning of fossil fuels. Right. And so it's indisputable evidence that we've changed the composition of the atmosphere and that composition change has not only predictable but then also realized consequences for the global temperature. And I have to add, I can't resist, there isn't two views of the history of the Earth that are scientific. Only one of them is scientific, and that is the 4.5 billion-year-old Earth. There is no biblically scientific view of the Earth's history.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You know, this weekend across a good part of Wisconsin, we saw a lot of lightning, too. And, you know, you talked about the number of deaths from tornadoes. I wonder about lightning. How many deaths does lightning cause in a year?
Boy, I don't know. Steve, do you know that number off the top of your head, roughly?
I know it's the most, next
right.
to flooding.
Yeah, it's
if you don't
in
count
the hundreds,
flooding, then
isn't
lightning's
it?
The most cause of natural death.
And I think it's in the hundreds. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that would be the number I'd want to throw out initially.
Yeah. It is the most significant threat that you get with severe weather because it's persistent. I mean, even if you don't have a severe thunderstorm, you're not getting orange-sized hailstones falling out of the sky or whatever they are, you still have to worry about lightning. And it was vivid on, was it Saturday night? I can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday.
Saturday night,
yeah,
I believe it was.
It was spectacular. I can't remember seeing a better lightning show than that night.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really was noteworthy.
Nicely viewed from inside a home.
Yes. We were in my neighbor's garage, which is almost a home. But it was a good view.
Oh, man. Andrew in Door County is up next. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I understand the effects of greenhouse gases combined with deforestation and how they're changing our Earth's atmosphere, but I've also heard of effects from changing sun patterns and changing radiation from the sun. I just feel like a lot of the weather is cyclical. I mean, if we were having this take place before the last ice age, we'd be talking about global cooling. I'm wondering if some of these effects aren't necessarily human-based and what you guys think about that.
Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely some non-human-induced variations that shape the climate on the planet. Some of them have to do with orbital variations of the Earth around the sun. Some of them have to do with the tilt of the Earth's axis that varies over long periods of time. Some of them also have to do with dust in the atmosphere and aerosols. We don't really have a really strong handle on how aerosol particles in the atmosphere are going to feed back completely. We don't understand them, how they'll feed back on the climate system. They tend to cool things down a little bit, and they do occur naturally. So there's a lot of competing effects. That is true. But the big ones about chemical composition seem to really be ruling the show right now. And that's something that's hard to not come away from looking at the data.
Interesting. Our guests today, as we talk climate and weather, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, professors here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking climate and weather with our weather guides, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, Larry Mueller here. You can join in at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we have a question about hailstorms, I think, coming up from Gary in Eagle River. Gary, hello.
Guys.
Hi.
Hey, about 3 weeks ago, we got hit by a hailstorm up here. And beat up our cars pretty badly and totaled the roof on the house and stuff like that. And a couple days later, we read about a bar out in Vail, Colorado, that gathers hailstones and puts them into their martinis as garnish.
Wow.
So lo and behold, 3 days ago, we got another hailstorm. So I ran out in the hail and put the car in the garage and then gathered some hailstones and mixed a couple of Bombay gin martinis up and put the hailstones in and noticed that they melted from the inside out, and we couldn't figure that out. So we were anxious to hear from you experts as to why hailstones might melt from the inside out.
Wow, that's interesting. I know they freeze from the outside in when they're first turning into pieces of ice, but I don't know, Steve, you got any insights on that right away?
Boy, yeah, no, that would be really... So I never would have guessed that, you know, because usually it's going to start to melt because the liquor or whatever you put in your martini is going to warm up the ice sheet from conduction.
Mm.
The only thing I could think of is maybe there were air spaces that went all the way into the center.
Right. I think,
so it's less dense there with air bubbles. Maybe that's what
I think that's it. I you know, it's almost like the outside coating of a hailstone gets lacquered by continuous melting and refreezing, so that water is that ice is pretty dense, and the stuff on the inside is not, because it freezes last.
Yeah,
I bet
so
you
if
that's
you get
right.
Some of it into the middle, or where there was air bubbles, it could melt from the inside out. Wow, I never would have thought of that. I am going to have a Bombay party.
Yeah, that is really a great idea. Especially
well, the hailstones look sort of like hollow, almost like donuts, you know, and so, but they're very tasty.
Yeah, yeah.
How big were they?
You got to, when you live in the North Woods, you've got to turn lemons into lemonade.
Yeah, I was wondering why I didn't make lemon martinis. That would have really made the story, rounded it out.
How big were those hailstones?
They ranged in size. This time it wasn't as bad as the first time. The first time they were at least golf ball size, and this one, most of them were about the size of your thumbnail.
Wow, okay, marble size or thereabouts.
Yeah.
But they're perfect for martinis.
Yeah, sounds
the
like
the small
it.
Ones. The big ones, I don't take up too much room. I
yeah.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. All right, well, that's a good I think you guys sleuthed that one out.
Maybe we figured that out.
Rod in Weyerhaeuser, it's your turn. Hi, Rod.
Thanks for taking my call. I don't know, I just kind of overheard the discussion here, and I, for years, heard this about what we put into the air compared to, you know, the volcanoes, for instance, and what have you, is nothing. And I'm just wondering, okay, when you refer to greenhouse gases, you know, when a volcano goes off, is that actually a type of greenhouse gas, or have we refined it to the point where the Earth doesn't produce that? And the point I'm trying to get to here is I can remember when I was in high school, and of course that was the big time, you know, when they were talking about the nuclear weapons and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And they were referring to if there ever was, God forbid, a nuclear war, there'd be this nuclear winter. So I'm talking in correlation. I don't know if you see where I'm going with that.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay.
I think so.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think this is an interesting question. There are greenhouse gases that will be ejected into the atmosphere in a volcanic eruption, but the much larger part of the climate-influencing puzzle in a volcanic eruption is the aerosol and the dust, and that stuff definitely provides a cooling to the planet. And in fact, the most recent really massive eruption that was well recorded was Mount Pinatubo, which exploded in the Philippines in 1990, and there's a... In all of the climate records, there's a dip in the global average temperature in 1991 and 92, and it's almost entirely attributed to Mount Pinatubo, because otherwise that's embedded within a time period where the temperatures are rising rapidly, and there's this little blip, and it has to do with the cooling that is a consequence of the dust and ash that's put into the atmosphere by the volcanic eruption. And that's the same principle that was being studied in detail in the late 80s, early 90s in this nuclear winter scenario. So there's no greenhouse gas involved in that. That's just if you destroy cement buildings and landscapes to such an extent in an all-out nuclear war, you're going to loft a lot of dust into the atmosphere, and that might well cool the planet in a similar way to the way that volcanic eruptions can provide a cooling, by shading the sun. Hmm. So it's not really a greenhouse gas question.
But there are greenhouse gases in volcanoes, like carbon dioxide is in volcanoes.
That's right.
Although the amounts are small, but over the history of the Earth, volcanoes have played an important role in putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
That's correct.
But the increases we've seen in carbon dioxide over the last 50 years cannot be attributed to volcanoes.
Right.
Okay. Thanks, Rod. Thank you for calling. Eli and Madison, it's your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just want to first thank you for having me on the air, and thanks for you guys being on today. Go UW Madison and go Evolution. just curious if you could recommend, I guess, a nice summer read about global climate change. There's a lot of heavy stuff out there, but something that be a little more informative for a political science student or somebody who wanted to learn more about the topic.
Hmm.
Well, Steve, what do you think?
Boy, you know, the one thing that comes to mind is Gore's book. But again, if you've seen the movie, then you've seen the book. So I'm trying to think of other things that might fit in. I know one you don't want to read is by Crichton, because that is science fiction, and I'm assuming you don't want science fiction.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the name of a book that came to mind for me. It's about the sort of Arrhenius, the Swedish scientist Arrhenius, who actually was the first one to propose that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases might change the global average temperature. I can't remember what that book is called, but it's very good. It's sort of like the discovery of climate science.
You know, actually, there's another good book. It's called something like The 2 Mile Time Machine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about how they look at the gases and the information that are trapped in air bubbles in ice sheets. And that's a fascinating story.
That's interesting,
that guy wrote.
Then there's one other one that I was thinking of called the Worst Hard Times. It's not directly about the climate, but it's about the Dust Bowl area in the United States. And it's a very, very good description of all of the different factors that went into that Dust Bowl era. Most people have the sense that it was just an out-and-out drought. Not the case at all. So it's it was a dry period, but it was really mismanagement of land use and all sorts of other circumstances that came together. And I think that's a particularly relevant story for our current times.
Yeah, I think that's a great book, too, because it does show, while it's not directly related to global warming, it does show the fact that humans can have on regional climate.
Right.
So the two-mile time machine was written by Richard Alley.
Yeah, that's
Richard
the
Alley,
one.
Right.
We've heard of that.
In 2000. And the other book was?
Is The Worst Hard Times by Timothy Egan.
The Worst Hard Times.
Right.
Okay, by Egan. All right. Thanks, Eli. Loretta in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Loretta.
Hi. I would like to have a website suggested that would give me a more specific forecast for wind in our area, including an approximate time of day and mile per hour.
You can probably get that from the National Weather Service website. I don't know what it is in La Crosse particularly, because I always access it through our own department website. Maybe I'll give you that one instead.
It's for Eau Claire.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to think of the closest weather service station to Eau Claire. I think it might be the one in La Crosse.
Oh, it's off in Minneapolis, but anyway.
Okay, Minneapolis. Okay. Then I think I would try it this way. I would go to our department website and then get to the specific Weather Service website from there, because that's the only way I know how to do it. Steve, maybe you know better.
No, you know, another way to try it, though, as you're thinking of that web address, is to go to Weather Underground and type in Eau Claire.
Oh, that's probably good.
Because there may be people living in your area that are actually submitting their weather data over to Weather Underground. So if you just get on the on the internet and search on Weather Underground, that site will come up, and you can type in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and it'll give you a site with temperature forecast and current weather conditions.
Okay, that would be forecast, not weather history.
That's right. They'll give you both current conditions and then forecast. They'll go out to 5 days, but I wouldn't believe it. I just look at, you know, the first couple of 3 days.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I've used Weather Underground. It works pretty well.
Yeah.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois is up next. Hi, Phil.
Hi, guys. I have a quick one for you. I read The Worst Hard Times, and I'm looking for something along those lines, and you've got scientists on, so I'll ask. Hmm. We're in agriculture on the state line, and for the last 9 months, we're running at about 270% of normal moisture. Hmm. I've only got about 30 years' experience, so I've asked some of these people that are second- and third-generation farmers when this happened last time, and they said they all just stand there and shake their heads. My question for your scientists is, when is it going to end?
Uh-huh.
That's when it dries out.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll bet you that you're running so far in the surplus because of the nature of the snow cover this year. It came, I think we've talked about this a couple of other times on the show, but only in passing. The snow came just before the ground really froze solid, and so we had such a deep snow here in at least southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois, that it never really froze the ground. So as it melted away in the spring, it percolated right into the ground, and it's taken a heck of a long time to get out of there. And on top of that, it's been a fairly wet April and May. So I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah,
I would say, given what we've heard about La Nina and its connection with a number of thunderstorm days, and it's only a statistical correlation, perhaps it will not go away this entire season. Maybe there will be greater than 100% capacity water content in the ground all summer long.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I looked at the National Weather Service one-month outlook, and they're looking for the border between Illinois and Wisconsin to be above average chances of precipitation.
So wetter than normal.
Wetter than normal, right. Yeah. So it's not going to go away for a month.
What would you guess my odds are to keep sustaining this kind of weather moisture at 250, 280% of normal? Is that the odds against that continuing?
I think they are against that. It would just be my impression. If you get four straight days in a row without precipitation in June, then you're talking about four straight days with temperatures above 85 without precipitation. That's going to dry the ground out a little bit. So I think it seems to me it'd be really hard to stay at that level. It might not be hard to stay above 100%, but it's going to be hard to stay above 200%, I'd think.
Okay, I'll call you in June and tell you if it's muddy.
Yeah, that's right. I want to hear about that.
Thanks, Phil. All right. Jason in Madison, I think, is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I had a question about polar shift. I was reading an interesting article that discusses that the Earth could possibly shift its magnetic fields, and obviously this would have tremendous catastrophic consequences. For your scientists, is there any evidence that this has happened in the past or could possibly happen in the future?
Oh, yeah. Steve, you know about this, don't you?
Yeah, I know that the switch in the magnetic field has happened in the past.
It regularly happens.
Regularly. And if you look at that cycle, we're due for one in a relatively short amount of time on geological timescales. But I don't think we understand the predictability enough of that to say whether it's going to happen in the next 10 years or 15 years or 20 years.
And, well, that, and that doesn't have any impact at all on weather systems and circulations of the ocean in the atmosphere, I think, as far as I understand it. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's what I would think, too. I mean, even if you're going to flip the magnetic fields around, you know, so the North Pole essentially becomes the South Pole,
yeah,
you know, the weather-related events like Aurora Borealis, we'd still be getting those.
Mm-hmm.
What other kinds of impacts would there be?
I think it would be huge impacts on navigation. I mean, I think that would be one of the major impacts.
I wouldn't want to be out on a boat when it happens.
Yeah, no. That would be bad. But other than that, you know, magnetism is not a force that has very much to do at all with the weather and climate.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, I wonder now with GPS and everything, if the flipping of the magnetic fields would have that much of an impact.
I guess it probably would be.
You know, because a lot of it is done with satellites now. And
yeah,
and
that's
those are
true.
Those knocked are navigating off the grid, sort of, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, that would be an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting it knocked off the grid.
Yeah. So there you have it, Jason.
How the the magnetic field protects us from different kinds of solar radiation and stuff. If there's a period of time when that shield is kind of down, you know, I think that, you know, there'd be loss of life and, you know, different species and whatnot.
Except I don't think that's happened in the past. I think you can, I think, is it the Mid-Atlantic Rift in the bottom of the ocean, the Atlantic, I think, where you can see where the polarity has shifted on a regular sequence, and it actually gave us clues about continental drift some years ago when it was still a controversial theory. But I don't think that those shifts don't come with mass extinctions or even noticeable small extinctions. So I think it's more that the whole thing just flips instantaneously or something like that, so that there's never a gap in any protection that the magnetosphere might provide for us.
Hmm. Thank you very much for calling, Jason. Appreciate it. That's interesting. Martha in Madison, your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about the hailstones melting from the inside out.
Oh, yeah.
That was interesting to me. I looked it up in the Science and Technology volume. And I don't know precisely why it melts from the inside out, but it does mention that a hailstone, if it were somehow cut in half, has a lot of concentric rings of clear and white ice. And also it says, check cloud physics and check meteorology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I wanted to pursue it, I could do that, but I haven't. But I did want to point out it's not just a solid rock, a solid thing.
Yeah. Yeah, those white rings are rings that are filled with air bubbles.
Yeah, it's less
and the clear ones are solid ice. And so what we were thinking was that if somehow there was a crack in the hailstone so that the liquid could get into the interior where that white ice is, because of the air bubbles in there, would be able to melt it faster because there's less ice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's kind of related to what you're looking up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, well, it was an interesting
It's an interesting thing, and I'm going to have to try those experiments. I don't necessarily need to drink martinis, I guess, to do it.
No.
Maybe 4th of July, Steve, in your backyard. I'll come over.
We'll run a field program.
Yeah.
Thanks, Martha. Laverne in Greenfield, your turn. Hi, Laverne.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I have never heard anyone say anything about our space travel having anything to do with changes in the weather or climate.
You think it has any impact,
No, I don't
John?
Think so. I think nobody talks about it probably because it doesn't have much of an impact. Certainly when a spaceship goes out off the Earth to outer space, it leaves behind a trail of effluents that probably have some of the very contaminants, pollutants that we've been talking about in our atmosphere. But it's a pinprick compared to some of the things that are going on daily with our regular, modern commerce. So I think that's the reason why you probably haven't heard anything. I don't think it has anything to do with changing the climate or the weather.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would think air traffic control would be more than space travel.
Yeah, this is more frequent. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Laverne. Linda in Pleasant Prairie, on to you now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share with you and your guests, my husband actually got struck by lightning and has lived to tell about it.
Oh, my gosh. That's rare.
It was a few years ago, and we had a big storm, and our house tends to flood. I live down in Pleasant Prairie in a community along the lake. And so we had a sump pump outside working, and it failed, so he had to run out there in the middle of the storm to try to get it unclogged or whatever so that we wouldn't flood in the house. And as he was holding his hand on the side of the house, the lightning struck the house, hit him, went through his arm, and threw him back.
Wow.
He couldn't stand up. I had to kind of, and he's a big, big guy. I had to kind of drag him into the house. He was almost like paralyzing for a minute. After he got in the house and my son was running around yelling, you know, do you want me to call 911? He was about 5 years old. He's like, no, I think I'm fine. And when he stood up, the whole side of his body was like he lifted weights so heavily for too many hours. He just was like, it just tightened up every single muscle on that side of the body.
Wow.
To this day, he can tell when a storm is coming. His hair shoots up on his arms, and if he goes under like electrical wires, the hair goes up on his arms. He feels the electricity.
Wow.
And they really don't know enough about it to either live or die from it. And, you know, it's, he's on a forum with other people that have been struck before. He knew a guy who eventually died. He ended up dying of a heart attack, but they weren't sure if it was related.
Mm.
But so I used to love to stand outside like an idiot, and now I fear it.
Yeah, man. So that's the only ramification so far is this hair standing on end now?
Yes.
And this is some years downstream now,
oh,
and is there
one other thing that a lot of the guys, because his legs, now he is a little overweight, but he has a lot of redness down at the lower part of his legs and his foot, on both legs. And I was always concerned about it, but when he went to the doctors one day, they're like, oh, yeah, that's red. Nobody had anything to say. Well, other people in his forum have all been mentioning, the ones that have been struck like him, have that same redness at the bottom of their leg.
Wow.
Which, you know, maybe coincidental, I don't know, but that just seemed kind of odd.
It does seem odd. I don't know if it's coincidental. That's something else.
I doubt it.
Gee.
Thanks for calling, Linda. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. And I love your guest. The story is great. Or the show is great. I love weather. I'm curious.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Carol in Wisconsin Rapids, I think, is up next. Carol, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. We love the program, too, my husband and I.
Thank you.
My question regards global warming.
Uh-huh.
You always hear that the temperature has risen like 1 degree or is going to rise like 4 degrees in 100 years.
Hmm.
How are those measurements taken? I mean, in theory, there could be an infinite number of temperatures taken on the Earth. Is there some kind of algorithm or something that applies to certain numbers in different places?
It's a good question. You do have to be you have to take a representative set of observations. I think it's on the order of 10,000 observations go into that number. Isn't that right, Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're taken over the oceans as best as they can be replicated there, and there's quality control on those from ships of opportunity and then also from ground-based stations.
Okay, I've never seen anybody discuss that. And
yeah.
It's like, well, it's kind of arbitrary.
Well, you know why they don't discuss it? Because it's boring and it's nuts and bolts.
Well, we kind of like that boring nuts and bolts.
No, I agree. I was just going to follow up with saying that you know, when you go to a media-driven culture the way we have on some of these big issues, then you're going to want to talk about the punchline instead of what really underlies it. And so the impression can be that nobody's done that work, but that's right at the front of the IPCC reports.
Okay.
How do we deal with the actual measurements, and what do we do to come up with our numbers? So it is a careful process.
Is there a place where we can look that up on the internet, some website that talks about that or something?
Yeah, undoubtedly. If you did a Google search on the fourth IPCC report, you would find a large document. You could get either the Reader's Digest version or the full thing.
Great.
In either case, it's going to say something about that.
That's the fourth IPCC.
Right. Report.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And someone else phoned in with a suggestion on a book, which the title of which was Rough Guide to Climate Change by Robert Henson. Do you know that one?
No, I don't.
No, I haven't.
Well, it's another one somebody suggested as a sort of a lighter version of the discussion on climate change. And guys, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
Oh, wow. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Flew by. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
And John. Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, Professor and Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They'll be back the last Monday of next month. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the issues of wind turbine siting at 11 o'clock, and then we'll look at bioenergies and biofuels at 11:45. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.